Good evening.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome, welcome. We're going to begin this evening's discussion with a discussion of Aristotle, one of the greatest philosophers of all time, although I was not privy to learn any of his material in the original, and if I learned it in a translation, I had absolutely no recollection. I apologize to all my philosophy teachers in college. But one thing I do remember from high school, actually, is Aristotle's theory of what constitutes a tragedy in a play. What makes a play a tragedy? So his definition of tragedy is an imitation of an action that is serious, complete, and of a certain magnitude, embellished with each kind of artistic ornaments, etc., 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 and there's a catharsis involved. And each tragedy has six parts to it: plot, characters, diction, thought, spectacle, and melody. And I'm not going to go through all of these things. But the first principle is the plot, and the second principle, which is what we want to talk about tonight, is about the character. What makes a tragic hero, according to Aristotle? And I learned this in particular in relation to Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller took this concept of the tragic hero and applied it to the common man, where Shakespeare's tragic heroes were King Lear and Othello.
Was it Macbeth?
Hamlet. You have Julius Caesar. All these tragic heroes are kings and great leaders. Arthur Miller took the same concept of the tragic hero and put it into, John Proctor in The Crucible and Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, et cetera, et cetera. And what made the character, what happened to this character in the tragedy is that some kind of change takes place in this character. The character goes through a catharsis, and then in the end everything is sort of like status quo, not necessarily good, but status quo. But the change should come about as a result of not a vice, but of some great error or frailty in a character, which is what he calls a tragic flaw. And what Arthur Miller calls a fatal flaw in the character, that it's something, not something that the character does that makes him tragic, but something about who he is. One small little fatal flaw that he has that brings his downfall. Anyone think of examples?
The death of a salesman, or what was his fatal flaw?
I didn't read it very recently, but I think it was his undying devotion to the American dream,
uh-huh,
and the concept that he
he just couldn't make it. And
he couldn't because he wasn't realistic, possibly, or he, I don't remember all the.
Wasn't he a salesman and he couldn't make it?
I don't remember if he couldn't make it, but he couldn't make it where he wanted to make it. He didn't understand that being okay was a quality also, that was good too, to just be okay.
I think he
okay.
had such an inferiority complex.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very poor self-image.
Mm-hmm. So here again, here's something, not something that he did that brought about his downfall, but something about who he was. We spoke about, what about some characters in Tanakh, possibly, who could be viewed as tragic heroes? Maybe? I don't know. Shaul?
Esther?
Okay.
You heard her.
Okay, what was his downfall? What brought about his downfall? What was his
downfall? With Tamar.
Okay. You're going to come to my Shavuot night class, right?
I hope so.
Okay. So we're going to talk about that there a little bit. Let's look at Chava a little. I want to present to you this evening. This is our second and last look at Chava, this class. And I want to present her as a tragic hero. And she definitely, clearly goes through, she falls from way up high. She falls. And the question is, what makes her fall? Why does she fall? And what happens to her as a consequence of this fall? So we're going to explore her. If you'll pass out, this is page one. Page one. And this is page two. And I want to start promoting a little bit to you ladies the, and that's it, just two pages. So you just pass them around. Everyone take one of what's coming each way. I know it's a little bit early to promote this, but I'd like to remind you of the Women's Day of Learning. It's going to be sponsored, well, I don't know who it's going to be sponsored by, but run by a federation again.
Mm-hmm. Is it 2 years?
They do 1 a year, but this year we're moving it up from December to October.
Oh, October.
Right, to the end of October at Akiva. Much better location. We're having the, thank you. We're having the same speaker as last year, Deborah Lipstadt, but she will be speaking about her expertise this year. Last year, I think some people were surprised that she gave a Torah study session, thank you, instead of speaking about her expertise, which for those of you who don't know, she wrote a book on how, in which she just, I don't know if the book was a doubt or she just discussed it. One of her areas of expertise is a Holocaust denial. Denying that the Holocaust happened or denying that it happened on the scale that we say that it happened. And in this book, she names a prominent British historian, David Irving, as a Holocaust denier, and he sued her for libel with unlimited resources in a British courtroom, and she won the case, and he had to pay all her legal bills. The description of the courtroom being packed with skinheads and neo-Nazis during the trial is just unbelievable. And she's a very no-nonsense person, very unpretentious, very down-to-earth and real to life. And I think a lot of people expected her last year to speak about Holocaust denial as a new form of anti-Semitism or something like that. And she didn't. She gave a Torah study class, but this year she will be talking about anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial.
Did she give the first lecture that she gave?
She gave the lecture and she gave one breakout session, and this year she'll be giving the lecture again and two breakout sessions. So one of the breakout sessions will probably be a Torah study, and then her lecture will be on Holocaust denial or something related to that.
Rena, why did you sue her?
Why did you sue her for libel?
Yeah.
I don't know, because if you go on his website, he's very clearly a revisionist, you know, not believing that the Holocaust happened the way it did.
Well, why?
So I don't understand, because he comes out very proudly as one who denies that the Holocaust happened on the scale that it did.
I can't understand. Why?
I don't know.
Unless, you know, if she was falsely accusing him, obviously that was not the case.
No, not quite.
To prove he was right.
So I want to, let's look at the story, this back to Chava. Keeping in mind this concept of Chava as a tragic hero with a possible fatal flaw that really led to her downfall. And the story that we're looking at is in chapter 3, Per Gimel of Bereishit, where at the end of the previous chapter, and on page 14 and 15, the end of the previous chapter, Adam and Chava are both, although Adam and Chava are not called Adam and Chava at this point, he is called Ha'adam, and she is called Ishto, his wife. He, Ha'adam, the human, and she is his wife, or his woman. And we're told that they're not embarrassed, they're not ashamed, they're completely au naturel with each other. Dressed in their birthday suits, as we like to say, and they're not embarrassed whatsoever. They're purely comfortable, simply comfortable with each other, who they are. Like my 2-year-old Leah is after her bath. So in Parag Gimel, we begin, the Torah gives us an editorial. The nachash, the serpent, the snake, was the most crafty animal of all. Asher Asah Hashem Elokim, that God had made. By Yom Elisha, he turns to the woman and he says, "Af bat, ki amar Elokim lo tochlu mikol etagan." Didn't God say to you, "You may not eat from any tree of the garden"? Now let us go back for a moment and examine indeed what God said and to whom He said it. So let's turn one page back, and you will find that right smack in the middle of the page in Pasuk Tadvav 15. Hashem has just created man. Vayikach Hashem Elokim et ha'adam. He takes this human. Vayanichehu began Eden la'adal l'shama. He puts him in Gan Eden to work it and serve it. Vayitav Hashem Elokim al ha'adam. He gave one commandment to him that went as follows: Mikol eitz hagan achol tochel. You may eat from any tree in the garden. But you may not eat from the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra, the tree of knowledge. On the day that you eat from it, you will die. And the commentaries, as we've discussed before, I think a year or two ago when we did this section doesn't mean that they will now acquire mortality and or that they will instantly die on that day. And is their situation going to change forever or just a little bit? And then we know what happens if they do have mortality, whether they had it originally or they've acquired it now. We're going to explore a little bit later on this evening. But their situation totally changes. They lose the privilege to be in Gan Eden. So back to our source on page 14. The Nachash says to the woman, to the Isha, God said to you, didn't God say you may not eat from any tree of the garden? Did God say that?
No.
Who did God give? So God said originally, you may eat from everything except for the tree of the garden. Who did he give the commandment to?
To the man.
To Adam. Okay. So he says to her, didn't God say, and he doesn't say who God said it to, just says, no, God say, don't eat from any tree. But she said, no, mi pri eitz hagan no chil, we can eat from the tree of the garden. Umi pri eitz hasher b'toch hagan amar Elohim, lo tachlu mimenu v'lo tigugo. But God said that the tree that is in the midst of the garden, she doesn't identify which one it is. God said, don't eat from it and don't touch it, pen tamutun, lest you will die. Same different than what happened or not? Did God indeed tell her that?
No, he said to Adam.
But did God even tell that to Adam?
No, he did not.
Which part is she adding?
That even if you touch it.
Right. So that part was never mentioned originally, and she's putting that in. Vayomer Nachash el Isha, the Nachash says to the woman, lo motamutan, you're not going to die. You can, like, imagine it. Ki yodei Elohim, ki b'yomachal teminenu, b'nitkechoi nichem. God knows. From the day that you eat from it, you will become enlightened. You will be like God, knowing the difference between good and bad. That's why he didn't let you eat from this tree, because he wants to stay up on the pedestal all by himself. All of a sudden, she looks at the tree from a different point of view. She sees that indeed it is a tasty tree, and some of the Mefarshim explained that until this point she thought that the reason God told him not to eat from it was because it was poisonous and bitter and nasty tasting. But all of a sudden now, she believes, for some reason, she believes this Nachash. And she looks at this tree in a whole different light, and she realizes that the fruit does indeed look very tasty. She sees that the fruit is tasty. That it's desirable for the eyes, the nechmad ha'etz last skill, and that the tree is pleasant and a way to give you wisdom. So she takes from its fruit and she eats it, and not only does she eat it, she gave it also to her man who was with her, meaning whom?
Adam.
And she ate it. And indeed, what was the result? Now, one could argue at this point that the reason she gave him to eat was because she assumed that positive benefits would come from this, and she wanted to share them with her spouse. Natural? That's what it appears. But indeed, they have that exact very result, that their eyes both open up, they become enlightened. All of a sudden, they know that they are naked. They grab these fig leaves and they make belts for themselves. They hear God's voice traveling through the garden. Adam and his wife hide from God among the trees of the garden. Interesting, it says Eitz Hagan, the tree of the garden, not Atzei Hagan, the trees of the garden. God calls out to Adam, Vayomer lo, Ayaka, Adam, where are you? And Rashi explains, God does this a lot.
Yeah.
He's giving you an opportunity to sort of come clean on this. He did this, I just taught last week to my students, the story of Bilam. That Balak, the king of Moab, sends messengers to Bilam to convince him to come and curse the Jewish people. So he sends these messengers, and these messengers show up at his house and say, please, 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 can you curse the Jewish people? And he says, well, I don't know, I'll have to ask God. Yeah, okay, such a close relationship with God. He didn't know the answer himself. So the people go to sleep, and he lies down, and God appears to him. The Torah uses great language. He appears. He happens upon him. And God says to him, who are those people, and what are they doing here? Hello. So Rashi compares the two stories actually, and he says this is the same kind of the situation that God is trying to open up, like so. Where are you from? You know, sit next to someone on a mission, right, and they're wearing their tag and they say they're from Wyoming, and you say, oh, so you're from Wyoming. Yeah, it says it on my tag, but that's an opening, a conversation opener. You know, oh, how many Jews do I know in Wyoming? Zero, but okay.
Do you meet anyone from Wyoming?
Not on the Michigan Miracle.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so now we're up to God. So God gives him this opportunity to own up to everything. Adam's answer is, well, I heard you were coming, and I was embarrassed because, you know, I'm not wearing any clothes, so I hid. So it would be more tzinnias. God says, who told you you were naked? Did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from? She did it. The woman who you gave me, she's the one who gave me the fruit, and I ate it. Turns to the next one in line. What did you do? Hanachas made me do it.
He did.
And the green grass grows all around on it, right? God turns to Nachas and says, Ki asita zo, because of what you did, you started this terrible chain of events. You will be most cursed of any animal. At the beginning of the parak, we started out, what was he? He was the most crafty and the most elevated. And the Mepharshim explained, you know, not only did he have legs, you see here he's talking. Some of the Mepharshim take that at face value. He's really talking. He's an intelligence that God gave him, human intelligence. But now you're going to be below, so below, you're going to slither on your belly, you'll always eat dust. I will put a fear, what does he explain this? An enmity, a hatred or a fear between you and the woman and between your descendants and her descendants. How many women in here like snakes? There you go. He will step on your head and you'll step on his ankle. You'll always be at each other's throats. Elisha Amar, he says to the woman, Harba arbe etzbonech veheronech. I will increase your suffering and your pregnancy. The etzev tabdibanim, with sadness and difficulty, you will bear children. You know, I don't remember which peer said this. It could be, oh, no, we're going to do it. Never mind. Yelishich to shukatech, and to your husband you will always yearn, v'huyim shobach, and he will rule over you. Okay, we will explore that somewhat. I still have some difficulty with it. You know, on my way to the hospital, when I was giving birth to the child on a Sabbath morning, our religious Catholic neighbor drove us to the hospital. And on the way, he and my husband, the rabbi, are debating the ethics of using an epidural. Isn't it going against the curse of Eve? I'm sitting there. Oh, my gosh. I said, okay. Stop the conversation. Continue it after the epidural is given, okay? It was in theoretical sense. I mean, they both clearly believed, you know, to give it, but it was a theological discussion, you know, but here, because that's what it says. The woman should give birth painfully, you know? Could you override that, God's? Well, okay. And to man he said, Tisha Amacha l'kol ishecha. Notice that he didn't say that to the woman. He didn't say, because you listened to the nachash. It's interesting. Almost like she's excused, it's expected of her that she would listen, possibly. We'll explore that. So to Adam he says, Tisha Amacha l'kol ishecha, because you listened to the wise voice, that tochal min ha'etz, and you ate from the tree, I shared to be tichal emor, that I commanded you the following, lo tochal min ha'etz, don't eat from it. Arurah ha'adama ba'avurecha, the land will be cursed because of you. Also strange. Be'itzavon tochlena, with hard work you will eat from it. Is that what it says? Hard work. Suffering. Suffering. Kol yimei chayecha, all the days of your life. Bekot v'dardar tachmiach lach, it will grow up thorns for you. Bachal at eshav hashadeh, you will eat the grass of the field. B'zeat apachat tochal lechem, you will eat bread from the sweat of your brow, ad shuchal ha'adamah, until you go back into the land. Ki mimena lukachta, ki afarata, ki alafarata shuv. Because that is from where you were taken. You were made from dust, you will be returned to dust. And at this point in the story, Vaikraha Adam Shem Ishto Chava. Now he gives his wife a name. He calls her Chava. Ki hi haita ein kol chai, because she was the mother of all living creatures. Vayash Hashem Elokim la'adam l'ishto ketonot or ve'al bishein. And at this point, God made them leather clothing, skin, clothing from skins, and they wore them. Very interesting. Notice, just go back for a minute. I'm doing a lot of pointing out issues, and I'm not going to address nearly half of them this evening. But go back two pages to page 14, when the woman is created. Actually, page 12, right before her creation. On the last line of page 12, Pasuk Chav, Vayikra ha'adam shemot l'chol ha'behema ul'ov ha'shamayim l'chol chayat ha'shadeh. Man is giving names to all of these creatures. Ula Adam lo masa ezer kenegzo, but he didn't find, in the process of giving names to these creatures, he didn't find a helpmate. Vayapel Hashem Elokim tardema al ha'adam vayishan, and at this point God puts him into a deep sleep and he creates the woman. She is built out from his side. Adam says, this time it's one from my bones. Lezot yikare isha kimi ishu kachazo, to this we will call woman, because she was taken from a man. But he gives her creation a name, but he doesn't give. It's only at this point, after the chait, that she receives an individual personality. Okay. Now let's look at some of our sources. How did she get to the point where she sinned? I mean, we said last week, I set you up with this, putting Chava way up there on a pedestal. She's the quintessential woman. And we all know the woman is always the brains in the operation, right? The woman is the one who runs everything. The woman is the one who has the Bina Yetira we talked about last week, who has the greater understanding of what's right and what's wrong and the connection between greater events. How could it be that Chava, just because he said to her, no, you won't die, was swayed by him, by this Nachash? So Rashi suggests in source number one, at that point when the Nachash said to her, you won't die, why did she believe him? Dachfa. He pushed her. Ad shenagabo, until she touched the tree. Amar la, he says to her, Kishem she'ein meita b'negiya, kach ein meita b'achila. He played on her misquote. He knew that God said, only don't eat from the tree. She said, God said, don't eat and don't touch the tree. Could be she was putting a gate around it, she was making it stronger to make sure she wouldn't eat the tree, I don't know why. But he pushed her and he says, you see, nothing happened. Yeah.
How did he know this?
How did he know what?
What God told Adam.
Because he was Arom. That was the preface that was given to us, that he was the craftiest, smartest of all the animals.
So he just hung around?
He hung around.
Learned everything?
Yes. He was, you know, slinky, sleazy, whatever. So this is what we have. This, yeah. Well, then it would say Aruma. So we don't want to really identify ourselves with the Nachash. Although I think I mentioned last week, I think one of our classes is going to be the women from Tanakh that we shouldn't learn from. Like Eshet Lot. And I'm sure we'll come up with a few Eshet's wives. You know. So that'll be one of our classes. Okay. So this is what happened, that she was convinced, she was teased into it. Why was she so able to be teased into it? A Torah Ha'isha, all of a sudden, says Rashi in source number 2, verse 6, Torah Ha'isha, it was at that point when he pushed her into the tree and she touched it and saw that nothing was going to happen to her. Then she saw the words, V'atad V'arashol Nachash, V'hin Ula. They made sense to her, V'haminatu, and then she trusted him at that point. And that's when he was able to tell her that now if you eat from it, not only will you not die, but you will benefit. The tree is good. She saw at this point that the tree was good, that it will make her like a god. Now, where are we going to continue? 1 minute. We're going to... There's another source. Don't tell me I didn't give it to you. Why you went to the woman first. Oh, there's question. I don't think I've got that. Okay, anyway, fine. All right, so that's what we have so far. That's why she started it. Then the question is, what made her give the fruit to Adam? We suggested maybe that she wanted to share some benefit with him. But let's give the woman a little more credit. That she knew, possibly, that something that she did was wrong. She was slightly uncomfortable with it. She knew in her head what was said. And even though she was convinced by the Nachar, she had that little feeling in her that she wasn't necessarily 100% right. It could be that when she pushed her up against the tree, she figured to herself, not that I will not die, so now let me taste, but I'm going to die anyway, so I might as well taste. And Rashi takes this idea and takes it one step further. Not only am I going to taste, I'm going to give Adam to taste. Look at the last source on the first line, the second half of source number two, but she turned on the Yisha, she also gave to her husband, Shalo tamud hi v'yichyahu v'yisha acharet. That she shouldn't die and he live and marry somebody else. There was nobody else at this time, so it was a very strange Rashi with the part with marrying somebody else. But she didn't want to be replaced. She knew that he would need some kind of Ezer Kenegdo. Maybe God would create a woman from the other side. I don't know. But she didn't want to be replaced. And she said, whatever my fate is, your fate is going to be locked into mine. It sounds very catty, doesn't it?
Maybe she wanted to just share with him.
Okay, but let's present this concept of wanting to share not just the fruit, but she wants to share her fate, her fate with him. We spoke last week about the deep desire that the woman has for the spiritual connection with the man. So Shlomo Avner suggests that that's what's behind this Rashi. That's what Rashi is trying to explain to us. That when she wanted the same fate, if she was going to have a certain fate, he needed to have it too, because their souls were connected. They were one and the same. They were both created B'Tzelem Elokim in God's image. Since they were connected so strongly, they were soulmates, if whatever her fate was going to be, his had to be the same. That was her B'nai Yitzhirah, that she understood that they needed to be connected in that way. It's a little bizarre, but bear with me. Okay. So what did she do that was so bad? I brought you in source number three the explanation of the Mesha Chachma that we've never really done this in class before. The Mesha Chachma, it's an easy way to remember the name of the guy who wrote it, because the Mem Shin Chach from Meshach are his initials, Meir Simcha HaKohen. Mem Shin Chach, Meir Simcha HaKohen from Dvensk. He was rabbi in Dvensk. He died in 1926. So he was the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, pretty recent. He does some good stuff. Here's what happened. He raises a very important question that we've already raised in class this evening. He made the Eta Chiboy La'adam at the time of the commandment to man, Az Hayat Haram Yitzirat Chava K'nevuah B'Ketuv. It was before the creation of Chava, as is clear in the text already. So why would we assume that she would know? And why is she held liable for transgressing a sin that she was never commanded to not do? Rakaita Begedra Hamutal Kog, she was still liable under the injunction Shemetuvim et Ha'av al Habanim, that of passing on from one generation to the next. Adam needed to pass this along to her, and he did pass it along to her. So even though it wasn't transmitted to her directly, how do we know that it was passed along to her?
She knew about it.
She's aware of it, right. So even though she didn't hear the mitzvah directly, he's very halachic, Mesha Chachma. That's also why I don't bring him very much, because I don't meet him very much, because he's so very halachic. But so because she was, even though she wasn't directly commanded, she was the secondary commandee, whatever. Okay. But in addition, the fact, Masha Natnalo Le'achol Haya Begedra Lifnei Iver, when she gave him to eat in return, she was putting him in a situation that it was impossible for him to resist temptation. And that's what she did that was incorrect. She'echshila oto mashaya mushar mipnei Hashem yitbarach. He was even doing a worse thing. She was making him do a worse thing for her than she was even. doing. His eating was even worse than her eating because he was the commander directly from the source. Lachain al hacheid atzmo, therefore, on the sin itself, mashallah shema hatzibur shemitzvah mimolida. Because she didn't keep this mitzvah that was commanded when she was born, so to speak. Huha adam shemenu lo kha, that she was taken from Adam. Therefore, she was punished with difficulty of giving birth to future generations. Makes sense a little bit. Because she violated being the second generation, she needed to keep the commandment that was given to the first generation. And she was like the one and a half generation. Therefore, she's going to now have difficulty transmitting physically to the next generation. Okay, fine. So we don't have to do the rest of it. I mean, you could read it if you want, but it's not really a task what we're doing here. So because she was commanded indirectly, therefore any transmission now of to future generations, she is going to have difficulty with. That's the direct connection. You're dealing with now what's the direct connection to what she did wrong and what's going to happen to her now. One of the other sources that I read that I didn't bring you today was that before, they were both immortal. They weren't going to have any children. So there was no childbirth. But now that eating from the tree brought mortality, now the having children is a consequence of that. I wasn't going to make you have to do that. By definition, raising children, having children, raising children is painful and difficult. And that wasn't even going to be necessary, that would not have been necessary had you not eaten.
So how would the world
from the tree? It would have been Adam and Chava forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
Just the two of them?
Just the two of them. That's according to that source, to that particular story. Okay, so now let's try to understand a little bit more about Chava, who she was. It's interesting, at least to me, that Chava doesn't get her individual name until after the whole story. I think because the Torah is trying to understand, the Midrash explains to us that the Torah is trying to understand how it was that she was so easily deceived by this nachash, by the snake. And the Midrash Rabbah in source number 4, gives a number of different reasons as to why she was named Chava, and the reason in the middle of the third line at the black letter says Rav Acha Amar Chavaya Chavech. Chavaya Chavech says the Matnot Tuna, which is what I brought you in the Rashi letters. Hanachashu haya nachashu meshit shocha v'ata hayita nachashu meshit la'adam. That Chava is named Chava from the Aramaic word for snake. That her name was snake, or serpent, or whatever you want to call it. Why? What does it mean that her name is now snake? The snake tricked you, and then you in turn tricked Adam. In source number 5, Rashi elaborates on this, and he says, Vayikra ha'adam, the Torah goes back to our original story of Adam giving names to all the animals. Which means that Adam was giving names to all the animals, and then Chava was created, and then he gave Chava the name Chava. But why was the story interrupted of him giving the names, interrupted with the story of what happened with the Chet of the Eitz Hadat? The giving of the names Chava mated with him, meaning with Adam, Kamosha Katuv, Uladam lo macha ezer kenegdo, mefichach ve'apel tardema. It was through the giving of the names that he found Chava to start with. Our Beinu B'chaya in choice number 6 says on the very second to last line, he brings our midrash, v'aldarach ha-midrash, shemi so Chava, the name of his wife was Chava, milashon Chavaya. The name is the cause. You are who your name is. This is our conclusion. That Chava was given the name Chava even before this whole story happened. But that wouldn't have meant anything to you had you not known the whole story. And the whole story happened because of who Chava was. She had this element of being the Nachash in her. It was in her name. When Adam gave each animal its name, he gave them the name of his quality, of its inherent quality. How else do you give someone a name? Right? You look at a dog and he's always smiling, so you call him happy. That's the name of the dog, right? That's just, that's what you, the way we name things. And that's how Adam named each animal based on its quality. And when it came to Chava, he named her Chava, which is related to the Aramaic word for Nachash. But that wouldn't have meant anything to us if we hadn't seen the story where she acted like the Nachash, so to speak, and why, now we understand why she was so susceptible to the Nachash's wiles, because she was so similar to him in character.
And did Adam do it intentionally?
That's what I'm saying, that he saw the mahut, the essence of each of the creations, and named them according to their essence.
And so he saw that in her.
Is that only one opinion of the other?
Yes. Oh, for sure. There's only one opinion.
Because you could look at it from the other side and say, okay, now she is going to be going through childbirth,
mm-hmm.
and therefore she is the mother of all future
children. Right, except that Chava and Chai are not the same Shoresh.
Okay.
There's a Vav and a Yod to fit. Now, the Torah doesn't really matter. The Torah does that very often, like Noach's name was given. It says that Noach's mother named him Noach, says Zayin Achaneni, this should be our comfort. But really, according to the reason that she gave him his name, Yenachamini, his name should have been Menachem. It's a different Shoresh. She left out a really important word and letter in the Shoresh, naming him Noach. Noach means rest, not comfort. So, but this is something that's often done in the Torah, and it's answered away by, like, it's an association. It doesn't have to fit exactly. It's an association. You know, you name, for instance, you know, my nephews and my son are all named after my father-in-law, Seymour. Nobody named their kids the English name Seymour. If anybody gave them an English name, Stephen or Stuart, nobody named their kids Seymour. So it's the same kind of thing. It's an association. They all got the Hebrew name Simcha, and they're all called Simcha. But it's the association, you know. So, okay, I just read something about that. Someone named, a girl who was named for someone named Sarah, and her name was Susan. I don't remember. Okay. Fine. Let's look a little bit further into her punishment to understand possibly a little bit more about what she did. Oh, it's a quarter to nine. So, excuse me a moment. Okay. I always had a difficult time, and I'm still working through it. I mean, I looked at an unbelievable amount of sources to come up with this class to put it all together to try to understand. It seems from her curse that she's reverting to that she's being put into an unequal state again. Whereas last week it made such an emphasis on the fact that Adam and Chava were created as equal spiritual beings, that they were not, one was not greater than the other, rather they were different than each other. They had different qualities. The woman had more of certain qualities, and the man had more of other qualities. But together, they complemented each other, and they were both created with Tzelem Elokim in God's image, so they were both equal spiritually. And now we have in her punishment, God says very clearly, Elishich teshuchateich, you will be craving towards your husband, v'hu yimshol bach, and he will rule over you. And there you go, women's lib movement explained in three small words. So let's take a look at some of the mefarshim. They have an interesting debate. Rashi begins, Elishich teshuchateich in marital life. V'achapiche, nevertheless, what does that mean? You're going to be desiring him in marital life. Nevertheless, ein lach meitzach l'tavo gafheh. Even though you will desire him, you won't have the boldness and the lack of temerity and shyness to actually do something about it. He will rule over you, meaning he will always initiate after his desire, but you as the woman will not. That will be your nature. Says Ramban, source number 8. He quotes Rashi with Tashmit for marital issues. Even though you'll desire him, you won't have the backbone to the boldness to say something about it. He will rule over you. I'll call me men and below me. Everything will be from him and not from you. This is what Rashi says. You gotta love with men. This can't be right. That very quality, which Rashi is explaining as a negative, has always been lauded and praised as a positive in women. As we see in source number 9, the Gemara tells us, the Elisech to Sukkatech, the reason I'm giving you source number 9 is because he quotes the end of it in the next line. The Elisech to Sukkatech, what does this mean? Melamecha isha mishtokeket al ba'ala b'sha'ashi yotel adarach. The woman will always miss her husband when he leaves. For who Yimsholbach means, Melamecha isha tova at the lev, v'ha'ish tovea b'peh. The woman wants with her heart, and the man, or the woman demands with her heart, and the man demands with his mouth. Zohi midat tova b'nashim. That is a laudable quality in women, this modesty, this keeping things inside, this not being demanding and stuff like that. So back to our Ramban, we're in the third line. Then in the whole Rashi can't be right. Kizah Shabbach Baisha, it's praised in a woman. Kamosha Amu, like Chazal said, Vizomi Daya Sabanashin. Rabbi Abraham Amar, the Ibradesha explains, he says, V'yali Sheikh Tishukateich Mashmaateich. That you will always, what does he explain here, desire to be your husband, meaning your obedience, to always listen to him. That's him. And what it means is, you'll listen to everything he commands you, because you are under his authority to do his desire. This is how Ibn Ezra explains it. And Raman once again comes back, Ibn Ezra, it's really nice that you're saying that that's what it means, but I never found a translation of the word teshukah mean anything other than that related to desire. The hanachon beinai, but now that he's knocked everybody else down, one day we'll do a class on that. Now that he knocked everybody else down, he says his own opinion. The hanachon beinai, what I think is the correct opinion is she'enishota she'tiyah nechshefet me'od el ba'ala. She's being punished that she should always want her husband. She should always miss him. She always wants to be with him. V'lo tachus l'tzar ha-herayon v'ha-leida. And that she should not be deterred, he says, by the pain of pregnancy and childbirth, or by the fact that v'hu yachazik bas kishivcha, or even if he would treat her as a servant, she would still desire him. The ein haminhag liot ha'eved mishtokek liknot azon latno. Usually, a servant doesn't look around. I want to be owned by a master. I want to get married to a master. I want to be owned by a master. I need to find a master. A servant's goal is always to go out and be independent. But the woman's desire, he says, is not that. The woman's desire is to always look for her master, so to speak. But the servant of Avayi Vachmi Menei Ritzonoh will run away from that. This is a measure for measure punishment. Why did he eat? Because she told him to. You had your opportunity, girl, and you lost it. Because you asked him to do something that wasn't a good thing to do. So now you lost it, and he's always going to ask you. Right. That's always that underlying thing that he didn't say no. What about us all being, but she could have also said no to the Nachash.
Right.
And
right.
Something that's interesting here, like her punishment was twofold. Her punishment was on eating it and on offering it to him. She wasn't punished for him eating it. She was punished for eating it herself and for offering it to him.
Right. It's not her fault that he took it.
Right. But she shouldn't have offered it to him. He says, okay. Like I said, it's a difficult thing to deal with. Let's look briefly at the last source, and then I'm going to suggest to tie it in, and then we could talk about it after. Bialshek tishucha teich. Shuk, market, shok, thigh, shokake, a strong mass movement of locusts or horses. This is her Shimshon and follow her. She's trying to understand what's the root of the word Tishukateich. What are we talking about here? The basic conception, accordingly, to move oneself powerfully towards one direction. Hence, Tishukah, the direction of feelings and the other efforts towards one goal, striving towards or longing. Like I spoke last time, whereas last week we explained it as the need for a spiritual connection for the oneness. That was the B9 here. I was a spiritual understanding and a reconnection within the oneness. Says the Mepharshim seemed to say that that desire for spiritual connection was replaced with a need to belong, to be under this rulership, so to speak. Towards one goal, striving towards longing. It is in the nature of woman to feel that she can only really live a full life in union with a husband. This is general. And yet it is only adding a fresh enunciation to who you show back. And I brought the second half because I think it sounded good, but I didn't really 100% understand what it means. So let's work through it together. The altered condition of the earth towards man, the henceforth it will only yield him his bread by his hard labor, except when you have a bread machine, already makes women more dependent on man, the actual breadwinner, and so endangers the original equality, which is what I mentioned before. Our now, the Shalom Elohim equality is now distorted by this concept of man ruling over women. And I have to tell you, you look around us, clearly the curse is still in effect today, not only on individual cases, unfortunately. Domestic abuse is much more common, man to woman, than woman to man, although it does exist both ways, although because you have the emotional and the physical abuse in me. Both of them are existing in men towards women, and probably more emotional abuse is existing in women towards men than physical abuse. But just in the world, we always say, this. I say very often, it's a man's world we live in, and I'm very strong in giving my students the strength to feel proud of who they are and not to feel trampled on and all this kinds of stuff. But unfortunately, the reality is that much of what we women is a man-focused world.
It's changed a lot, yes.
Though. It's changing. It's different.
Your generation and mine has changed.
It's definitely different. But even with the changes...
Yeah.
It's still a very male-focused world. I'm not talking in the realm of Shemirat HaMitzvot or anything like that. But in societally, it definitely has changed a tremendous amount. But it's we had, who were all these women in Merrill Lynch? Merrill Lynch, one of the top brokerage firms in the world, has a list of 25 women or so out of the New York office who are bringing a suit of sexual harassment. You know, this is part of what we're talking about. So here's what he says. So it endangers the original equality, which is what I mentioned. This is a part I need to add. Thus it develops in general, where the Torah does not bring the recovery and peace in all this, and establishes man and woman again in an equal God-serving calling of being priest to God, and again makes the wife the crown of her husband to the invaluable pearl of his life.
That's how you reduce the woman.
But I didn't get the end.
Yeah.
It develops, so the even though he rules over her,
reveres her,
he also seems to revere her. It could be maybe, like we say sometimes, that it's the external, that the world is going to appear that way, that the man will rule over the women, but that the woman is the backbone that keeps it going, so to speak.
That's right.
Let's look at it that way.
Every successful man is a woman.
Right.
Pushing him.
That's right. So I want to suggest to you something very interesting that I read in this book where Shlomo Avinow, I've been quoting him a lot. This shir isn't from him, but I get bits and pieces from him, what he said. He said something very interesting to bring us back to our fatal flaw, our tragic flaw of the tragic hero that he has. We spoke last week in a lot of last week's classes from him about putting Chava up on a pedestal, Chava being the quintessential woman, that she was the woman of all times, that she was leaps and bounds even above Sarah Imenu. And he says, Chava, in all her perfection, and humans, in all our perfection, programmed into the perfection of humanity, is the necessity of failure. Now, it's a very difficult thing to understand. Sorry.
That's what they always say, though, that's what makes people human.
That it was all of Chava's perfection, she needed to feel. He points out, he says, the Nachash, a lot of the Mepharshim say that the Nachash wasn't a snake, the Nachash was a form of the Satan that was coming to, coming to get her to sin. And one of the people who quoted Rav Chaim Halevi, I think, said that the Satan now, what happened when she sinned before, the Satan was in second person, he was outside of us. So it was easier sort of to say no to him, to deal with him, but with the sin we've internalized it, which also fits into this concept of Chava with Nachash, her getting her name almost afterwards, that she's internalized the qualities of the Nachash, she's internalized the Satan, and now that's the Yetzirah that's in us, and it's much harder when it's speaking to you in the first person than when it's speaking to you externally in the second person. But he said this idea that, you know, so he says that the Satan was sent by God. God is the one who sends the Satan. Satan doesn't act on his own free will. It's a shaliach from Hashem, which implies, he says, that the world in its perfection is set up for failure. Not that it shouldn't work, but it's set up for trips, let's say.
Challenges.
Yes. And that's what makes it the world. I am not one, the reason this appeals to me is something that's difficult to me, but the reason it appeals to me, I am not one to go with simple answers for things. I don't like it. I had a student this week. We were talking about the Chatzuel family who was murdered on the road last Sunday. And my student, and I wrote on the board, learning Monday morning, I wrote on the board, it's a custom that when somebody passes away to do your learning also on the Archite in honor of their neshama, to get closer to God. So I wrote on the board the names of each of the members of the family, and I said, today our learning will be in their honor, in their memory. And at the end I put a phrase, God should avenge their blood. And one of my students says, what do you mean? I said, well, they didn't die in a normal kind of fashion, so God should really make things right. She said, well, how do you know? Maybe it was the two-year-old's time to die. As people look at this, but it's filtered into Judaism so blatantly. We say this when a child, God forbid it should not happen, but when a child comes to meet its maker, we answer, oh, he did his tachlis. He fulfilled all the mitzvahs he was supposed to do on this earth. How could a two-year-old keep all the mitzvahs? There's such a concept, and I think that this idea of saying, oh, she filled her tachlis, it's too simple. The point of this thing that he's saying, or Avinar is saying, and you should have heard the talk that he gave after the week, he gives a parsha class every Monday night for the day after in Israel, the day, not Rav Avinar, Rav Elon gave us, unbelievable, whatever. We heard part of it in Shul. Anyway, that part of what this idea that appeals to me so much, this concept of that humanity in its perfection is set up for, Kishlo Note, he calls it, for trip-ups, for failures, for small failures, that it's programmed into us. It has to be that way. You know, that's something, it's a very complex idea, but it's something that very much, in its way of not making sense, makes sense. If it was perfect in its perfection, which it is perfect in its perfection with its flaw, but if it didn't have a flaw, it wouldn't be this world. We would all be angels. We wouldn't be people. And then what's the point?
Small failures can give you humility, but big failures?
It's all how you look at it.
Yeah, there's always learning that goes on from every little or big failure, if you look at it.
The Gemara says that when something bad happens to you, a person should be mefashvesh b'maaseiv. So you should look into all his deeds. The classic explanation of the Gemara is that you should check what you did to see what you're being punished for. But the explanation that I like from the Gemara is you should look at your attitude towards things. Something could be viewed as a terribly big failure, or it could be viewed in a different way. Use the same failure, look at it as an opportunity for growth, a growth opportunity. It's a difficult thing to do, but that's what makes us stronger and what makes us human. So, there we go.
I have a question. I don't see any of this where Chava was really set up to be anything so special. I mean, what she ever did, we said last week, or it was brought out that she was like this way above everyone.
So where do you say you're from this again?
And where is it coming from?
Just great birth to the fact that she was the first.
Oh.
That was it. Just because she was the first, she was the only person who was in Gan Eden. Imagine, you have to be a certain kind of person to be in Gan Eden. You know?
Just
by virtue of her created, but that's the way she was created. But she was created perfect. That was the point of last week's classes, that she was created perfectly. We brought Midrash says they're created at age 20, at the peak of life, at the peak of their virility and youth, and, you know.
So it wasn't anything she did.
Just by virtue of being first. Okay. When you're first, and she's now the paradigm for everything that comes afterwards, by definition, you know, it gets, the stamp wears out the more it's used. And the first time it's the clearest. So, that's it. All right. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
See you next.